Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Good morning, Kieran. It's Sunday morning. It's bright and sunny, unfortunately. It's Questions Day. We're recording our Questions Pod for tomorrow. But there are a couple of news stories that we will need to get through, Kieran. Frank Lampard, for example, women's pay in the FA Cup. But more importantly, Kieran, there's an issue that you and I need to discuss, otherwise it will hang over us for the whole of
morning.
I'm not angry, Kieran. I'm disappointed. Just tell our listeners, our lovely listeners, what it is you cooked for your dinner last night.
I cooked Guinness and cheddar soup, which comes with, and I know it's sacrilege for you in terms of the Guinness side of things, Kevin, but I'd suggest try it first and then come back and be continually disappointed. This is possibly the best soup I've ever tasted. You start off with some leek, onion, carrot, red pepper, and you sauté those. You add the Guinness to smooth everything out, add some chicken stock, and it's absolutely and it's looking great. And then finally, just before serving, you mix in around about 100 grams of fresh cheddar, and it is amazing.
First of all, Kieran, can you call it cheese and Guinness soup? Cheese and Guinness soup, I could just about live with the name. Guinness and cheese soup is not that. But in all my life, I've never sat in the Porson's Arms looking at my first pint of Guinness of the morning, of the afternoon.
of the morning.
I've never sat on a match day in the Porson's Arms looking at my pint of Guinness thinking, do you know what that needs? Parmesan. it's just right. I just worry what Uncle Terry would say, really. I mean, Uncle Terry's a man who's got enough on his plate anyway, without learning that his beloved nephew, the man who used to do the numbers for him and his rackets, has been reduced to Guinness and cheese. So, Kim, we do have a couple of stories we should mention before we get into our questions. And the first one is Everton announced the appointment of Frank Lampard yesterday. And I was going to ask you how much you think that may have cost them. But inevitably, the way Everton have been working lately, how much is it going to cost when they sack him in 18 months' time, which seems to be the way, the pattern?
Well, yes, I mean, certainly from talking to some of our friendly lawyers, they make sure that their clients are always very well protected. And the cost of getting rid of managers is pretty prohibitive these days. If you take a look at what's happened at Chelsea since Roman Abramovich first acquired the club in 2003, I think they're up to around about £90 million in total payoff costs. So it is something which has to be borne in mind. And also, as we were discussing a couple of weeks ago, those costs are not exempt from financial fair play. So for a club such as Everton, which has been living pretty much at the edge, they've had to sell players, they've had to get players off the wage bill in all ways that they can in order to enable themselves to go back into the market to recruit, you know, first of all, players on the pitch, but also a new manager.
It is a small story, Kieran, this next one, but it's in a way, it's almost the start of hopefully something bigger. And I'm not saying we should take credit for this, Kieran, but just a couple of weeks ago, we were speaking to Sophie, the goalkeeper from Clapton Community FC, about the iniquities of the way the FA Cup money is distributed between the women's game and the men's game, to the extent that it costs Clapton a lot of money. It costs them a lot of money to play in the third round of the FA Cup at Plymouth. And now, yesterday, the FA announced that they are launching an investigation into those pay disparities. And it's about time too, isn't it?
Yes. Some people will say, and there's been quite a lot of debate about this on social media, but you know, the critics, I'll rename them, the dinosaurs, saying, yeah, well, tough. There's some pretty misogynist attitudes towards women's football, which is ridiculous. They say, who cares? Well, Well, football fans care, and football players. If you take a look at the attendances, you know, for the final of the Women's FA Cup, the final was very well attended, and certainly some of the qualifying matches are also getting decent attendance as well, because it's a sport which is worth watching, and it's a choice. You know, I always say to people, when people say, "Well, you know, you're trying to ram it down our throats," no, we're not. We're trying to give a good sport, a growing sport, a sport which has really positive implications for health, for education, for social gathering, and so on. We're just trying to give it a better opportunity to grow. And the lack of financial support from the FA, I think, has been poor. But what we've also seen is that with the new TV deals that are coming through, with the new sponsorship deals that are coming through, that it's not just progressive liberal blokes like you and I who think that women's football has a really positive future. And it is over time that that the FA should have really got its act together and given clubs the opportunity to at least break even when they're attending matches.
Yeah, plus also you're talking half the population of the planet here, Kieran. Yeah. And also, as I keep saying to those same dinosaurs, none of the women we speak to are demanding equal pay with the men's game. What they're demanding is that a club like Clapton shouldn't be £4,000 out of pocket, because the money they get for getting into the third round of the FA Cup is about £1,600, and it cost them £5,500 to transport their squad down to Plymouth and stay overnight. That's all. When the men's game, you get £86,000 for being in the third round of the FA Cup. It's somewhere in between £1,600 and £86,000 is the correct amount of money, basically. So it's good that the FA have finally at least acknowledged that they at least need to do something about how long that will take them, because we know that sometimes pace of change at the FA is geologically slow. We don't know, but we'll keep across that as much as we can. So, questions, Kieran. And the first question I hinted about on our last pod, because we've spoken a lot about the European Super League, but this question comes from Akudinobi Kazarachi. I hope I've pronounced that right. And Akudinobi's question is, there's an African Super League on the way, which is backed by FIFA and apparently the CAF as well, which is the African FA, essentially. While some journalists have stood against this, nobody's really sure what the financial aspect of this will be for the teams not in the Super League, but everyone agrees it will be bad. And also, what do FIFA gain from this, given their stance on the European Super League?
Well, there's a lot of politics in football, as we know. CAF is effectively a subsidiary of FIFA. And I think it's FIFA have backed this, although Infantino first announced the potential Super League. I think it was way back in 2019. CAF, which is the as you say, the African Federation, it has been very vocal in support of a FIFA World Cup taking place every 2 years. So yeah. You know, there's a bit of there's a bit of mutual back scratching taking place here. As far as this Super League is concerned, it looks as if it's going to involve 24 clubs, 20 of which will be by invite, and 4 will be on some form of merit basis, which that's got big parallels, as we know, with the Super League. It's not how good you are, it's how big is your social following, how close are you to the people making the decisions, and so on. So that's a first cause for concern. I think for me that the challenge will be is who's going to watch it? Is it going to be financially independent? Why does Africa lose so many players to the European game? The reason simply is that it doesn't get enough people attending the game in terms of match day revenue. So even if you're getting big crowds, the ticket prices tend to be quite low. So there's not a lot of money going in. The TV revenues are close to zero because many African football fans prefer to watch the Champions League and the Premier League and La Liga. And that's not a criticism of them. It's, you know, we all know that the Premier League and the Champions League are global sports and they're very glamorous and so on. When CAF did sell their TV rights in 2017, and there was a big fanfare about this at the time, they sold their rights to a company called Lagardère, which I believe is French, for a reported $1 billion. And people go, wow, that's absolutely incredible. This is great because this will allow African clubs to be able to offer some decent wages to their players and perhaps to reduce the number of players who take the view that the only way they can make a living out of football is to seek their employment elsewhere. If something looks too good to be true, it's probably not true. And this TV rights deal collapsed very, very quickly. The money didn't go across. So I think there is a challenge. If you're going to have a Super League, where's the money going to come from to fund it? Why is FIFA behind it? Well, it's a Trojan horse. It's a way of, if this does prove to be successful, could FIFA therefore get into bed with the next European Super League proposers and say, look, we were involved with it in Africa. We will sanction it in Europe as well. So there's a lot of politics involved, and that's the rationale behind it. As far as other clubs are concerned, because there is an African Champions League at present, it would completely destroy sort of many of the domestic leagues. Nobody's decided, you know, Africa is a very big continent. There's many countries there. You've got 24 clubs now. Some of those, I mean, you know, a bit like the Super League, the Super League was only split between, was it three countries? Well, what happens if there's only half a dozen countries that are allowed to play in the African Super League? It's not done on a merit basis. And what you will find very, very quickly is that players from other African countries will leave their domestic leagues to go and play in the Super League clubs because they're offering more wages. So there'll be a talent drain, and I think it would have a hugely negative consequences for those other countries in Africa who don't participate.
You've answered my question, Kieran, which is yet more proof that we've been together too long. Because Akinjobi is quite right to worry, because, you know, we've seen Gambia, for example, get to the quarterfinal of AFCON, one of the smallest countries in it, their first time in it. They did very well. But you can't imagine a Gambian team would be invited to be in the African Super League. You'd guess it would be, like you say, the big hitters, Cameroon, Nigeria, Morocco, Egypt. But I suppose some people would say, well, it's better that there's a talent drain within Africa than African players all heading for Europe. I mean, I don't agree, but some people might think that's an improvement.
They might do. My response would be, I don't think it's going to make money, because where is the audience going to be? There will be some interest. Even if it is more lucrative than what we presently see, compared to what you can pick up from certainly from one of the big five leagues in Europe, and indeed many of the, you know, the likes of Portugal, the Netherlands, Belgium, and so on, African players can earn more money playing in those leagues, and certainly that they can from their domestic leagues. If we just have this Super League, which is 24 clubs, you will find lots of dead rubbers. Once it starts, because you've got all these teams in it. If you are a Moroccan team and you're playing an opposition from South Africa and you're 14th in the Super League, who's going to go and watch it? It's the same old problem as before.
I'd be interested to see what the viewing figures here are for AFCON. So the BBC had a game yesterday, because I suspect a lot of English football fans only watch the games in which their players are involved. So I'll watch the Ivory Coast, obviously, unless Wilf's not picked, in which case I probably won't watch the game. So I suspect that's a pattern repeated across the country. But I would be very interested to see what the numbers are, because there have been some cracking games. Yeah. From a macro story to a slightly smaller one, it comes from Dan Wright. Hello, Dan. Dan says, Bristol Rovers rightly got a lot of grief for their job advert for an unpaid internship for a data analyst. How common are these unpaid internships in football? Which is an interesting question, Kieran, because for the first 18 months of this pod, you and I were essentially unpaid interns.
Yes. It's a complex one, this, because if you want to get a job in the football industry, one of the things they're looking for is experience. So how do you get experience? Well, sometimes you've got to work for nothing. And it's not just the football industry. I mean, you work in the media industry, and so, you know, we're both aware of you know, newspapers and other media organizations offering internships which are unpaid. And the downside of that is that it reduces the talent pool. You know, if you're coming from a middle class or a rich family, and you've got parents who can help to finance you working there for a period of time, that's great. If you're coming from a working class background and you are, you know, every penny counts, you've got to potentially take a job which pays. So that's the downside. There was an investigation into this by Sporting Intelligence. Now it's a few years old. This. But they found 319 unpaid posts in the football industry. Now, this is a report from 2013. I'm hoping things have improved since then, but I suspect that's not been the case. You know, I work in education. Now, I'm involved in football finance education, and we have students come in, and we will try to get them, you know, short term work placements, which could be, you know, if it's 4 to 6 weeks. And it's a project, then sometimes the clubs will pay, sometimes the clubs won't pay. My view is that it's, you know, it's part of the course,
yeah.
And it's complementing what the students are learning in theory from giving them some practical experience to demonstrate their skills. That goes on to their CV, that assists them. So if it's on a short-term basis, I think it is justifiable to a degree. It would be great if the clubs paid. And to be fair, yeah, many of the Premier League clubs do pay. I think as you drop down the divisions, where every penny really does count, and I'm not saying the clubs are doing the students a favour, because there are mutual benefits, but you can see how if a club's losing money, to go to the chairman and say, we want to go and pay this person who we've never met before, what do you think about it? You know, the owner of the club, the chair, or whoever it's going to be, is perhaps going to be not enthusiastic. However, if it is a 6 to 12 month placement, as we do see occasionally, and that is unpaid, in my view, completely unacceptable. That is working for nothing. You know, that's a job as opposed to a little bit of work experience. So I think we've got to distinguish the two, but it does happen quite often.
We've had this discussion before, Kieran. There are too many TV production companies who still bring runners in for nothing. One or two companies, Zeppotron, for example, should be named and praised because they refuse to do it, because they understand that it does prevent people from outside the middle classes and the upper classes who can afford to do it from getting a foothold in TV. Essentially, it's exploitation, Kieran. And for every, the argument is always, well, you know, that runner who's bringing you your coffee could end up as a TV producer one day. They could, but the chances are they won't. So in the meantime, those young people are working very hard for no money, very long, and it's not right, and it's, you know, it shouldn't be allowed to happen in football, because there's no excuse for not even paying expenses or travel and too many of them. Too many internships, when they say unpaid, they mean actually unpaid. They mean it actually costs the kid money to do that job. It's not just unpaid. They're out of pocket, and that's wrong. Now, our next question, Kieran. I'm almost reluctant to ask, because it comes from unnamed listener. In general, my policy is not to ask questions from unnamed listener, because I suspect it's Guy. It's producer Guy slipping his own questions in. To pad out a pod that doesn't need padding out. And I've got another reason for suspecting this might be producer Guy, because the question is, how deep in the shit are Barcelona? But unnamed listener is not only circumspect about his or her own name, he actually hasn't been able to bring himself to spell out the word shit. So he's spelt it with an ampersand and an exclamation mark in the middle, which, again, produces guys of a delicate disposition, especially when it comes to talking about money. But he's quite a sensitive flower, which, again, is a reason why. But the question is, Kieran, how deep in the S ampersand exclamation mark T are Barcelona? Is their debt pile a danger to the club? And what would be the consequences of them failing to make the Champions League?
Well, in terms of debt, and you know, I think we've had this discussion before. Debt in its own right is not a problem. It's financing the debt and its cash flow in relation to debt that's critical. So if we take a look at Spurs, you know, Spurs have huge debts as a result of the new stadium project, but they have rescheduled their effective mortgage on that to 2051, and until then they've got an interest only deal on part of that debt. So their cash flow has been very, very carefully planned, very professionally organized. They've got low interest rates. So, you know, I think that's an example of where debt can be beneficial. The extra revenue generated from borrowing as a result of the increased capacity and the multi-use stadium far exceeds the annual costs. In relation to Barcelona, I dug out their accounts, and I think that their accounts is about 160 pages, of which the first 150 pages are glossy pictures of Barcelona players cheering and smiling and so on. And then the last 10 pages is the detail in terms of the numbers. Barcelona have borrowed €256 million over the course of the last 2 years, effectively to fund the wages and the other operating costs of the club. So that's a big red flag. You know, I always, you know, people ask me about borrowing. I always say you borrow long-term for long-term projects, you borrow short-term for short-term projects, where you're going to get the money back. Now, you know, paying out wages doesn't necessarily get you very much back. So that is a cause for concern. Their total liabilities are over €1.5 billion. But what Barcelona have managed to do is that they've managed to go to some of their banks and their lenders and providers and reschedule that debt. So they kicked the can down the road. I think there was a genuine concern that there were some repayment dates arising in the near future, which would have caused significant problems. So if you reschedule your debts, that alleviates the problem. Barcelona still want to develop the stadium. They want to improve and expand the new camp, and that could end up adding a further €1 billion. But if that's long term and it's interest only, and it generates more money from match day, from hospitality, from the museum, and so on, then it can work. So they've been through a tough 12 months, but they're still here. That's the important thing. I think it would be a very brave bank manager to call in some of those loans. Although if you're borrowing from investment banks, as we've seen with some of the clubs in Italy, you know, the investment banks have got zero social conscience, and they'll take you out of the knees.
If God forbid anything was to happen and Barcelona were taken down, would they be taking down other Spanish clubs with them?
Yes, they would, because they are one of the biggest draws in Spanish football. So there would be implications for the TV deal. And also, if you take a look at their debts, they owe substantial amounts of money on transfer fees. So, you know, it can, you know, it is a house of cards, football, in terms of there's an awful lot of money sloshing around within the industry, with one or more clubs owing the other. And going back to the second part of unnamed's question, in respect of the non-participation in the Champions League, is worth, you know, if you get through to the final stages, you're looking somewhere in the region of €100 million. In 2019, remember when Liverpool and Spurs played in the final? Yeah. Barcelona actually earned more prize money than both Liverpool and Spurs due to the somewhat complex way that UEFA allocate money. So, you know, they've got a very high coefficient. Well, what happens is that UEFA take into consideration your performance in the last 5 to 10 years when putting money into various pots. Some of the other Spanish clubs have got knocked out earlier, which assists Barcelona. So it's, you know, €100 million potentially from TV money. You know, Spanish fans are now returning to watch matches at the stadium itself. So you're probably talking, you know, €5 million per match from that. Sponsors are happy, they'll pay bonuses. So yes, it is important, but I think they could probably survive 1 year without.
So as in football, so as in life, so the rich clubs get money for doing badly and for doing well.
Yes.
Doesn't seem quite right somehow, does it?
Yes. It's a form of parachute payment that UEFA have, but they don't want to call it a parachute payment.
All right. Okay. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by Pact Coffee. Big coffee is bad coffee, full of underpaid farmers and low-quality over-roasted beans, all of which just leaves a bad taste in the mouth. Pact is changing the coffee industry from the grounds up.
From paying a price that's more than fair to knowing farmers on a first-name basis, Pact builds long-term relationships that flourish, putting the needs of their partners first and providing coffee that's personal to their customers. With Pact, you'll get award-winning speciality coffee, freshly roasted to perfection for your order, and ground just moments before it's shipped. There's over 15 different coffees on the menu at any given time to choose from, including Great Taste 2020 and 2021 winners.
So make a pact to make better coffee now. Price of Football listeners can get a free brewing kit with their first order. So go to pactcoffee.com, that's pactcoffee.com, and enter the code POF at the checkout when you sign up for a Pact Coffee plan to create your flexible coffee subscription and get that free brewing kit. Make a pact to make better coffee. Better for the farmer, better for the consumer, better for the planet.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Our next question is from David Kane, and David says, much is reported on Chelsea's player hoarding, with half the population of West London, it seems, being sent on loan. With their transfer activity being largely credited with their academy player sales, what are the operating costs of the academy to deliver such profits, and how does that compare with other Premier League clubs? So Pep Guardiola recently credited Jack Grealish's transfer to similar sales, quoting a net £40 million. But despite the fanfare of the City campus, their academy doesn't seem to get as much acclaim. Or is their approach just not as obvious as Chelsea's?
Academies and player farming, you know, young men player farming, it is a big issue. You know, we've discussed EPPP before, the Elite Player Performance Plan. Chelsea are very good at it. In terms of the costs of running a Category 1 academy, from the people I've spoken to, they reckon the minimum cost is £5 million a year. But for clubs such as Chelsea and Manchester City, it's going to be 2-3 times that at least. I mean, Manchester City, for example, they have educational opportunities for their academy players, and that they get sent to a very good school. So we are talking large sums. Yeah, we're certainly talking a minimum, I would say, of £10 million for Chelsea and Manchester City. Having said that, over the past 5 seasons, Chelsea have generated £526 million from player sales, and Manchester City have generated 308. Now, some of those will be players who they've bought and sold. So you've got Eden Hazard, you've got Leroy Sané. But if you take a look at Chelsea in particular, Tomori, Tammy Abraham, And what we're seeing with Manchester City is that they're picking up quite a few loan signings. So they're getting loan fees from players previously at their academy. And on top of that, they're getting sales, especially to Europe, for fees that go under the radar. So, you know, if you sell somebody for £3 to £4 million, it never gets discussed these days.
Well, as it happens, Kieran, we have a fairly big story about academies coming up in our news pod on Thursday. And I'm proud to say it's about my club, Crystal Palace. It's about aftercare for youngsters who don't quite make the grade. Hopefully we might be able to get somebody from the club on to talk us through that. But in the meantime, we've got a question about transfers for the big grown-up players. And it's about a phrase that we use all the time, Kieran, now, without really probably thinking through. The question comes from Glenn Entwistle, which is a great name. Glenn must have been a bass player in a folk band sometime in the 70s. But Glenn's question is, when a player is sold, and there are all sorts of add-ons in the deal, and it seems these days no one is just bought or sold. That sounds harsh when you put it that way, isn't it? No one's just bought and sold. There are always add-ons. But Glenn's question is, how are these add-ons managed logistically? Is it down to the selling club to keep tabs on things like goals and appearances, and then they invoice the buying club? Or is there an automated way that this happens? Automated? Automated way. Surely if it's down to clubs remembering, these sorts of things could be lost or forgotten when a club is sold or bought, or if someone messes up the filing system. Now, that might have happened when I was playing Sunday League football, Kieran, but I can't imagine that Premier League clubs have got a filing system for this sort of thing, have they?
I think it's slightly more sophisticated than that. First of all, the contract has to be lodged with the Premier League, with the EFL, with the Football Association. So there will be a record kept by third parties. Ultimately, it would be the responsibility of the selling club. Normally, the club secretary would have a list of all outstanding potential payments. So the club secretary, potentially the finance director as well, would be monitoring these as they get closer and closer to payment time. And when the contingency is struck, now that could be appearances, it could be international, could be chosen for international caps, it could be winning trophies, avoiding relegation, then an automatic invoice would arise on the back of that. So, it's like all things. If you and I do some freelance work for somebody, it's up to us to check that they pay us, rather than the buyer to automatically make the payment.
Yeah, it's nice to hear Finlay telling the neighbours that he's had a wonky jump, and he's that literally sounded like a dog going, "No, it's fine." He gave it quite easily. I only had to whimper for 3 seconds. I'll try and do it during the pod. I know that the other bloke on the pod doesn't. He gets all upset if I whimper. Martin Butterley, which is a great, and if Glenn Entwistle was the bass player in that folk band, Martin Butterley was without a doubt the drummer. But Martin Butterley said, "I've noticed with some recent transfers, for example, Lukaku to Chelsea, that players have their medical overseas. Now, how does that work? Do they do them at other clubs' training grounds or the national team training ground or a hospital? If it's at other clubs, I'm sure it's easy for the City Football Group, for example, to use one of their own. But do most clubs use ones they have good relationships with? And, of course, are there fees involved?"
Well, yes, there certainly would be a fee involved if for anybody providing medical services. What will happen is that there's an approved list because a football medical is different to, when you or I go to the doctor every 3 or 4 years and they say cough, and then we have a chat about we need to go and lose a bit of weight and, cut back on this, that and the other. So it would be a specific medical which involves a series of steps. There will be a lung capacity test. There will be clearly there will be tests of bloods and so on. But it's fairly standard as far as football clubs are concerned. They'll also for players who have been injured historically, then it could involve X-rays to check in relation to are there any outstanding issues from those. It's everybody is their favourite doctor. Football industry is a very expensive one. You don't want to buy a player who subsequently turns out to have an existing injury or physical condition. So it tends to be people that the football clubs themselves trust. And football's a small industry, and the medics they like is a small industry as well.
It's always worrying when the doctor tells you to cut back on this, that, and the other. So Finley, we said doctor, not vet. Fine, calm down.
Oh, he's seen a squirrel.
Oh, my Lord.
I'll close the door.
Yeah.
He'll probably open it to
yeah, there was a slightly odd standoff in my garden the other day when Smudge, who's she's currently her winter weight, basically. Right. And what I can only describe as the world's plumpest squirrel. They're both staring at each other with that South London look. It's like, don't make me come down here. But they're both looking at each other like, you've put on weight, haven't you? The medicals thing is interesting because I know talking to players who played their football in the 80s and 90s, Mark Bright, for example, that the medicals in those days were much more, shall we say, rudimentary than they are. Basically, in those days, if you could walk to the doctor's couch on your own 2 feet, you tended to pass the medical. But I've seen some of what's involved in Premier League player medicals now. They are over two days, quite a lot of time as well. They're proper extensive medicals. And I imagine, of course, that is a lot to do with the insurance companies as well, isn't it?
It is, but you know, from the club's point of view, if you're investing 20 million quid,
yes, fair point,
in buying anything, you know, if we were buying a house for what we can afford, because let's face it, you know, we're not producer guy, we're not in the £1 million bracket when it comes to property, but you know, we'd want a survey done to make sure that as with the building society or bank that was lending to us, or Uncle Terry, as the case may be.
Of course, indeed. Our next question comes from Gary Knowles. I doubt if Gary was in a folk band, but possibly he might have been the second keyboard player in a synth band from Essex in the mid-80s. Gary Knowles says, who pays the club's travel expenses in European competitions? Not only must some of these journeys be quite expensive, but if the club themselves have to pay the cost, can the Man Cities of the world, who are funded or sponsored by an airline carrier, save costs as the airline would lay on special flights for them, presumably, therefore benefiting further on FFP regulations? That's an interesting point.
Yes. You know, clubs will almost certainly charter a private plane for these. Yeah, they won't be on the plane with regular punters. We do have quite a few clubs these days. You know, we've got Arsenal, City, who are sponsored by airlines. Then we see some of the other Premier League clubs, such as Manchester United. I think they have their official airline partner is Aeroflot.
Yeah.
And so what would normally happen is first refusal would go to your partner and say, we've got such and such a match, how about it? From the airline's point of view, it's in their interests to offer that flight for nothing or next to nothing, because then they can put out on their social media, here's Manchester City arriving in Milan or Madrid on the Emirates plane. So there are significant benefits for having that relationship and monetizing it. It does therefore save the club's costs. And that is beneficial from a profitability and sustainability point of view. When we drop down the tiers, the clubs are paying for the cost themselves. So if you are a non-glamorous club and let's say you're playing in the Europa Conference League and you're from Albania, you're going to have to go and just bear those costs yourself and hopefully make enough money from the competition to offset those costs elsewhere, which, you know, tentatively brings us back to what we were discussing earlier with regards to the women's game. For the FA to not give a minimum amount of financial assistance with regards to travel. Let's say you could easily do it. If a club has to travel more than 30 miles, then there is assistance given from the FA itself. Yeah. Simple solution.
Well, still on the economics of European football, and also this is a question that makes more sense when we've already talked about Barcelona being paid to do well and not do well. Greg Dubrow, I'm sorry, Greg. Greg's got one of those names that could be pronounced eight different ways. It's Dubrow, so I'm going for Dubrow. Please let me know if I'm wrong. But Greg says, does it make more sense for a weaker Champions League team to try and qualify for a Champions League knockout round tie they'll most likely lose? Or are they better off not qualifying, getting the move into the Europa League with possibly more matches, so more money, and a better chance to get into the last 16 or beyond? Or is the money and the prestige gained from a guaranteed home match with one of the top four, six clubs in Europe a better deal?
It's a tricky one, because if you get into the last 16 of the Champions League, you get 9.6 million euros, which is substantially higher from getting into the first few knockout rounds of the Europa League. If you manage to win the Europa League in total, you'll get 13.7 million euros. So one of those clubs is potentially going to be better off. Having said that, as Greg quite rightly pointed out, if in the if in the last 32 and the last 16 of the Europa League, you're playing clubs who, should we say, don't have very much of an allure, you might therefore have to cut your prices for your home matches. You've got your travel costs to be borne, as we've just been discussing. And of course, there is a chance that you're going to be knocked out, and you'll probably get around about one and a half million euros for those first couple of matches. So it's a bit like in some of those some of those TV game shows, do you take the box now or do you deal or no deal type of stuff? Yeah. So it is a gamble. And also on a longer term basis, there is the issue of your tenure coefficient to take into place, which is more skewed towards Champions League performance. And within the Champions League itself, you're on 2.8 million euro for a win, compared to 500,000 euro in the Europa League. So you're picking up five and a half times as much. So it could be that the money you've actually earned in getting through to the knockout phase of the Champions League is probably more than enough to alleviate not being in the Europa League. That's the prize money side of things. Then you've got to say, well, hold on, what about the size of the club? If it was Manchester United or Spurs or Barcelona or Bayern, they've got big grounds with big capacities, and they can be earning on top of that, 3 to 4 million pounds a match from match day income, from ticket sales. So there's a lot of cogs in the overall wheel. But overall, I would say you're better off going for that Champions League, because you get one big draw, you get Real Madrid, Barcelona, Manchester United, whoever it's going to be at home. And you can then go to your hospitality partners and say, well, we'd normally charge you, 150 quid a ticket for a box per person. Yeah, it's Manchester United, it's Barcelona. We've not played them. It's going to be a grand a ticket, and people will pay up.
I apologise, Kieran. I was slightly distracted during that very good answer, because an ad popped up on my laptop for an invoicing payment and payroll app for the self-employed, one of whom, according to the example on his ad, made £16,000 profit in the past 30 days. That's generally annoyed me.
That's producer Guy.
Producer Guy's not doing his banking on an app.
No.
not unless Coots have started doing that. I can't imagine that Coots have started doing apps, have they? It's very unlikely. Well, last time I checked, I think Producer Guy was still banking at Gringotts. Our last question comes from Paul Rhodes. And Paul says, whilst unlikely to happen, what would be the legal issues around a player announcing his retirement whilst under contract, taking 6 months off and then coming out of retirement to sign for another club? Now, because of my cavalier approach to research, I can't remember the player I'm thinking of, but it certainly happened before when a player has retired through injury and then found himself fit 6 months later. And there was huge problems with the insurance company because he'd been paid off, but he came back to play football. So it's not, it is unlikely to happen to Kieran, but it's not impossible that it could happen.
Yes. A lot would depend upon the remaining length of the contract when the player did retire. If his original club kept the registration of the player, then he would not be able to resurrect the career 6 months later, unless they agreed to some form of write-off. Again, if there's an insurance payoff, and again, I'm with you entirely. I do remember this cropping up in respect of one player who came out of retirement, and the insurance company said, "Hold on, we've given you a payout under the scheme." So there are a lot of complications. The The club for whom the player is presently playing before he announces his retirement is protected. So it's to stop a player saying, I've had enough, I want to retire early, because he knows on the QT that somebody's going to offer him more money in 6 months' time to come out. So there is protection there for both the insurance companies and the original club. If he's not had a payout, and if the original club says, well, actually, he was a pain in the arse and we're just glad to get him off the payroll, then sometimes that can work for everybody's favour.
Well, on that note, thank you, as ever, to all of you who have made a contribution to the pod via our Patreon site. If you'd like to join them, then thank you very much. You can make a small monthly contribution to our always free-to-air pod at patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. Please try and include your name, because it unsettles us otherwise. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, thanks again, folks, for the feedback. Thanks for the support for the show. It's great, and also a big thank you on a personal level to some of our listeners who've been in contact with me, who have shown me a far cheaper way of transferring money to my mum in Ireland. this doesn't involve courier based work, as Uncle Terry would have said.
Somebody said to me, surely the cheapest way is to go to Ireland with a wedge of cash, isn't it?
Yeah, I've not been able to go to Ireland. I'm hoping to arrange that fairly shortly. If you want to support the rest through Patreon, thank you very much. You can do that for as little as £1 a month. But if you just want to give us some good karma, and myself and Kevin, we don't understand how this works, okay? But apparently, according to producer guy, the algorithms are that if you leave a review on the Apple app or the Spotify app or whatever app you use for your podcasts, it helps us in the charts. It helps us to negotiate guests, because they look at the charts and say, oh, these guys aren't complete non-entities. They're doing okay. If you give us 5 stars, that really helps. It doesn't matter what you say. You could say you would rather have the show hosted by Chuck Norris and Jerry Halliwell, and it wouldn't make a blind bit of difference, by all accounts. I think that'd be quite a surreal show as well.
Well, you can guess which one of those I've worked with. We'll have that discussion off air. And when you do go to Ireland, Kieran, for the love of God, don't tell them that you're using Guinness to put in soup.
Absolutely.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. The Price of Football. Price of Football.